Hello, bonjour, tansé, and welcome to Canuck is a Slur, a podcast about cool, cursed, curious, cringe, clubbing, cranky, car jumping, kid-friendly, constitutional, cubic, Quebecois, cooperative, Calgarian, cup-winning, Cree, creepy, kickable, concrete, queso, and cancerous Canadian culture and history. I am Kelly, and with me today is Kirsty, the host of Our Stories and Ourselves, a podcast about the way our minds make stories and stories make us. Today, we're here to discuss the story of a country whose transit infrastructure was so poor that a one-legged man was forced to jog across it until he died.
Well, that's one way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, there's many ways to tell a story, aren't there? And isn't that sort of what your podcast is about?
That is indeed.
Yeah, so how are you doing today?
I'm good. Looking forward to the weekend.
Yeah, as we mentioned before we started recording, it is Friday night and this is the party that you and I are having, so.
Yep.
Two extremely cool people.
Very much.
The thing that we are talking about today is Terry Fox, and specifically in the context of the series of episodes we've been doing, this is part of the Greatest Canadian TV series, and this is Sukhyun Lee's pitch for Terry Fox as the Greatest Canadian. If you're not familiar with the format of these episodes, you can head back to the first episode of this podcast. We explain what the Greatest Canadian is. You can go back to the first pitch episode we did, which is Bret Hart's pitch for Don Cherry. But the short answer, if you don't want to go back, is that the CBC in 2004 held a contest where Canadians would name the Greatest Canadian, and the top 10 vote getters were given a TV episode created by a sort of quasi-celebrity advocate who is going to explain why everyone should vote for them in the runoff vote. So this is the episode we have for Terry Fox. If you don't know who Terry Fox is, we are about to explain it. But just really quick, the pitch episode opens with Sukhyun Lee in Bangalore, India, explaining that there is a Terry Fox run happening there. So kind of demonstrating that, like, hey, this guy's impact has reached all over the world. So what I was wondering, what I was listening was, did this ever reach you in the UK? Had you had any exposure to any of this before I sent you this episode?
No, I absolutely never heard of Terry Fox before, either in the UK or in Australia. So yeah, it was completely new to me.
Right. Because you're from Australia, you live in the UK, so you have two points of data for not encountering this.
Yeah.
That really struck me when I was watching it. I thought that you had said, oh yeah, this is new to me. And then as I rewatched it, because I rewatched this today and yesterday, and I thought, wait a minute, the opening salvo here is that, hey, isn't this guy so ubiquitous? And I thought, well, I don't know if he's that ubiquitous if the guest is not familiar. This could also be something that has changed since 2005, but.
Mm-hmm. It was quite weird to come in on because, you know, you sent me this, you know, I may not have heard of this, you know, Greatest Canadian, and then I hit play and the. It opens in India, talking about how this global reach of, and I'm like, global reach of who?
Right. And so the listeners, some of them who are also unfamiliar, will still be wondering this. So I'll jump into that here. The story of who Terry Fox is explained over the course of this 40-minute episode. So what we've done before is we've kind of gone through the episode blow by blow. In this case, we're going to do it a little bit differently. We'll drop in a few clips, but I kind of just want to discuss it. So to catch the audience up, I'm going to give the extremely compressed version of this story. In 1977, at the age of 18, Terry Fox was diagnosed with osteogenic sarcoma, which resulted in the amputation of his right leg above the knee. Driven by his experiences in treatment, including being around kids with cancer, as well as taking a cue from an amputee who'd recently completed the New York City Marathon, he trained himself in running with the intention of crossing the country. 2 years after his amputation, he finished a 27-kilometer race and then started laying plans for the larger journey, which began on the 12th of April 1980. The goal was to raise awareness and funding for cancer research, and he set a target of $24 million, one for every person in the country at the time. He started at the waterfront in St. John's, Newfoundland, on the east coast of Canada, and ran a marathon, or 42 kilometers, every day, receiving more attention and support as time wore on. Unfortunately, on September 1st, Terry was forced to quit outside of Thunder Bay after making it 5,373 kilometers in 143 days. Although he pledged to finish the journey and refused to let anyone continue it instead, his worsening health never recovered and he died on the 28th of June, 1981. The commonly held understanding is that his cancer metastasized his lungs, which eventually led to a bout of lethal pneumonia, although I think it merits further consideration that his downward health spiral was precipitated by the prospect of having to spend even one single day more in Northern Ontario.
Brutal.
That fall, the first ever Terry Fox Run fundraiser was held in his honor. Since then, hundreds of millions of dollars have been raised in his name. Now, that takes about 90 seconds to read. Mm-hmm. That leaves us a solid 40 minutes of content to go in this episode.
Yeah.
Was that kind of a little bit of your feeling as well?
They did flesh it out a bit. I mean, I think it was mm-hmm. it was interesting the way they told the story of his journey across the country. Mm-hmm. I guess if they were talking about someone with, say, a longer career, like the Don Cherry episodes.
We definitely accused them of filler in the Don Cherry episode. I mean, he has more mm-hmm. he has more career to talk about in terms of chronology. Mm-hmm. I think our issue at the time was that he had less in terms of substance.
Yeah.
But
it was interesting, like, following the journey across the country and seeing it start off, the footage of him starting off with just him and then, you know, slowly, bit by bit, a couple of people coming out to see him, bigger crowds, events. Mm-hmm. Whether you really needed 40 minutes for that, I don't know. But there was definitely something there in how they built the drama and built the sort of energy of the story as it went on.
The storytelling as they do it is, it's engaging storytelling. I mm-hmm. would not fault them for that. I would say that the whole impression I got from this episode in terms of the actual, the craft, I keep wanting to say filmmaking, it's not a film, but in terms of just the direction and the editing and everything, it's very competently done. I think yeah. it's, to go back to our usual whipping boy, I mean, the Bret Hart Don Cherry one was just a fever dream to watch. But this one is just like, it's well made. So I don't know how different, like, you know, their crews are, or the Don Cherry one was full of little animatics. This one had zero animation in it, right? It was all film, right? It was all just people in real life, mm-hmm. which I think certainly, if nothing else, aged better.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Although it was fun seeing the, like, little 80s short shorts and the cars and the film quality.
Oh, you mean like the actual archival footage?
Yeah,
like
the 80s archival footage.
Yeah. I mean, just the stuff that from 2005 mm. has aged better because they weren't doing like the Angela Anaconda animations and shit. Mm. But yeah, like, I don't think there's too much to speak to in terms of the quality of it. As I said, probably the biggest technical issue I could bring about is just that there's a decent amount of filler, right?
Yeah.
You can tell that they went to his parents to get some information on his childhood. Maybe we can drop that clip in here because this is one you highlighted, the story she's telling, where the finish what you start story.
Mm-hmm. He could never resist a challenge. Even when he was a little kid, he'd sit in his high chair for hours, stacking one wooden block on top of another. Then he'd have a tantrum when they toppled over. As soon as they were knocked down, he was determined to stack them up again, over and over, until he had mastered it. If there's one Terry rule of thumb, it's this. Finish what you start. Never quit.
That one is like, okay, this is a little bit of reaching, right, to fill this in?
Yeah. But I did find it interesting they also mentioned that he was just a good old Canadian boy. Like, you know, his dad drove a train or worked for a train company or something. His mum was a homemaker. You know, it was just such an idealized, and I mean, it probably was their family and that's fine. But it was interesting that there was that emphasis put on the family unit.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. And this will come up later. So do put a pin in that. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the substance of the story, I do want to quickly touch on the presenter. So the celebrity advocate in this case, as I said, was Sukyun Lee. Her jobs are multifaceted: musician, actress, filmmaker, broadcaster. She's also done theater. Like, she's done a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to summarize her as one thing. One thing I think that is interesting is that I had never heard of her before we started doing all these episodes on The Greatest Canadian. It's mm-hmm. just totally unknown to me. Just, yeah, I think, like, enough to kind of be Canadian famous, or certainly like 2005 Canadian famous.
Yeah.
And I also want to say, like, she's done a lot of interesting stuff and she has kind of a wild backstory. It's just that I think I would like to actually maybe cover, for example, like a film or something that she's made later on. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit outside of our scope today. don't have a ton to say about her specifically. I don't want to say it's because she's boring. I think she's just a very competent presenter. And mm-hmm. there's not much to say about that. But
yeah.
when she speaks, you can tell she's been a broadcaster. She's been a theater person. She's very well spoken. Again, to go back to the same well, she's so much better spoken than Bret Hart, for example.
Yeah, she's telling the story really well. You know, she's got the emotional beats. She's finding a way to put them in there without overwhelming it with her own stuff because, you know, she's making a case for someone else.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think sometimes those portfolio careers, I think some people call them, they can be quite hard to sum up because, you know, there's lots of different things. And if people have done something interesting over here and something interesting over there and something interesting somewhere else, you know, it probably makes them more interesting, but it's hard to go, okay, well, yeah, so they were in this movie and then this movie and then this blockbuster and then they were, you know, Spider-Man Forever. And
yeah, no, I agree. I think that is kind of the mark of an interesting person who is doing exactly what they want to do. Something that is a bit hard to sum up, I think, is actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did you look into her at all? Did you scroll her wiki, anything like that?
I did have a quick look of her Wikipedia, but yeah, other than going, huh, that's a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Nothing really jumped out at me.
There was a little bit of fun trivia, so especially for the listeners of our show, she got her start, much like our friend George Strombolopoulos, as a video jockey on Much Music. As always, if you don't know what a video jockey is, ask your parents. And apparently the year she was hired, she kissed a woman on live TV to celebrate sexual orientation entering the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as a protected category.
Nice.
It's kind of fun. Yeah.
That is fun. I like that.
That's bold in your first year at work. And on her last day at work, she mooned the camera on air.
I love it.
Yeah. And
love it.
The one thing, I don't know if it came up on this, in her filmography as an actor, she didn't create this movie, but this was from the guy who made Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which I haven't seen it. I just know the name.
Same.
But he made this art house movie about like a sex therapist and like people going to orgies and stuff. Like it was a movie where it was thematically about sex. But the actors who were generally regular actors had unsimulated intercourse with each other.
Okay.
Yeah. I was like, I didn't realize that was a thing, but that's just like a whole box unpacked some other day. Also, yeah. Not a Canadian movie, so nothing, not really in our scope, but I was like, fuck, all right, that's confident to go and do.
Yep. I'm sure you could find a tangent if you tried hard enough, but, you know.
Oh, and I often do, but I was just like, yeah. So she's definitely done interesting shit, but that's basically all I have to say about her, because other than that, she doesn't do anything notable in this episode, I would say.
Yeah, just presents it competently.
Yeah, so for me personally, I don't know about you, I'm not here to criticize her. I'm also not here to criticize Terry Fox, but, and this is why I brought you on, because I think this is very much in the wheelhouse of your podcast. What about the narrative itself that's being presented to us?
I took lots of notes and I've watched it a couple of times, but it's more like a hagiography than a biography, right? So,
is that how you say that word? Because I've always wondered.
I think it is. I mean,
Hagiography. I think I've said it before in the show and I'm never confident in how to pronounce it.
That's what I think how a couple of history podcasts I listen to say it. So let's just blame them if I'm wrong.
Yeah. And if I continue to say it wrong in the show in the future, you can blame Kirsty. So
cool. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. The first note I had, which you kind of already touched on, is the kind of good old Canadian boy thing I put down. There is a sort of nationalist attitude to it, which is unsurprising. I mean, the entire Greatest Canadian Project, the whole concept is quite nationalist. You can't really escape that. But I mean, I can't help but twig it every time when they go like, you know, he really embodies the spirit of Canadians. And I'm like, I think what he did, really cool. Running a marathon every single day is fucking insane on two legs.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely bananas. Like, I think the longest I've run at once is 12 kilometers. And that was more than enough. Like, it's a massive, massive thing that he did.
So what he did is cool. Do Canadians embody that? Do I see the spirit of how they're presenting it in other Canadians? Or do I find often that Canadians can be quite selfish and quite lazy? And anyway.
I mean, I don't think any nation actually has a single character is part of it, you know.
And I mean, I don't think anyone who is on this show or has been on this show has been big on nationalism. That's not the tone of the show at all.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons we're covering the greatest Canadian episodes is basically a critique of nationalism. So we are kind of preaching to each other and to the choir here. But the biggest thing that I would say about the run itself, you know, the connection that's constantly made is it was so inspiring that he did this struggle through adversity, through physical challenges, through weather, through delays, you know, all in the name of, like, you know, raising money and awareness. I would have found this run inspiring whether it was a fundraiser or not.
Yeah.
First off, right?
The sort of, he did it for the kids, you know, he didn't want a sponsorship. There's a clip a bit later on where it's like, oh, you know, he wasn't interested in endorsements. He was all about the kids. And it's like, and yeah, he was. But yeah, there's something in the way they're telling it that's...
Oh, I have some very specific notes on that later. So.
Okay, cool.
Like, he gets really emotional at one point where he's like, this kid who's 10 and has the same, you know, cancer he does, is riding his bike behind him. And it's like the most inspiring thing he's ever experienced. I'm like,
yeah,
absolutely. And that kid would be riding behind you whether you were raising money or not.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you are a person who has lost their leg and is running across the country literally just for its own sake. Even if you said, if you did a press conference and said, I am doing this to prove that anyone can do anything.
Yeah.
Dope. That rocks. Mm-hmm. You get full marks for that. Would I have voted you greatest Canadian? I don't know, but I would never begrudge anyone voting for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my criticisms about the narrative are more to do with... So I'll give you an example of where this kind of thought occurred to me at an early age, which is when I was a young child playing hockey. I don't remember how long we had to do this for, but at least once... We had to do something called the skate-a-thon, right? So you would have to go and I think there was a certain amount you had to canvas people for, right? So you'd ask someone to sponsor you. You go up like door to door and then you go to your like all the parents at your brother's hockey game and you go like, will you sponsor me for the upcoming skate-a-thon? They could sponsor you per lap, but everyone just gave you a flat amount, right? They give you $2 and you're part of your way to probably 100 or something was the arbitrary amount I was meant to go for.
Yeah, yeah. I know the thing. We didn't have an ice rink, so we did round laps of the oval, which is, if anything, more tedious.
Yeah, and so I went and took the fundraising as a given. I'm doing something, funnily enough, I can't actually remember what the money went to, whether it was just toward like the Minor Hockey Association. I don't know if it was for a charity. I think it was just kind of for us kind of thing. And I mean, if it is, you can have critiques around that of like, why was this, you know, suburban hockey program not simply funded by like charging the parents? Anyway.
Yeah.
I
mean, I think we were running laps of the oval to fund a fence around it to stop rabbits digging it up. So we sprained our ankles running around it.
Hell yeah. But I really remember having raised my money and then going, okay, I've raised, let's say it was $100. And then I had to go do the skating. And I remember probably even asking my parents, like, I raised the money. Like, do I really have to go and skate these laps? Because I didn't want to skate the laps. And I mean, whatever, lazy ass kid, get out of the house, go do something. But I think that core of the idea of like, why is the money only released on condition of doing the kind of pageantry? Is it only worth funding cancer research if something does something incredibly inspiring, right? And I actually went out and did a little bit of homework to back that point up. Before we get to the stuff that I've prepared, one of the early moments in this that kind of tripped my filler radar, it's about 6 minutes in, it's one of the first scenes where she's almost literally doing the like Webster's Dictionary defines a hero as when she starts talking about like ancient Greek stuff.
Yeah.
If you want to define a mythical hero, nobody does it better than the ancient Greeks. For them, a hero is someone who achieves greatness through struggle. Someone who takes whatever abilities the gods have given him and works on them, develops them to prepare him for his quest. In other words, for mere mortals to make it in Greek mythology, they have to earn it the hard way.
And you're going, okay, yeah, this is where the padding it out starts. We have to kind of jump into this framing device about Greek heroes.
Yeah.
I have another timestamp. Yeah, 13 minutes in, we go back. Like, once again, we've invoked ancient Greece.
Heroes are timeless. Their accomplishments are so daring and so inspiring, they're remembered forever. For thousands of years, we've been captivated by the legends of ancient Greece.
epic tales of strength and sacrifice. One of the greatest tales is not about a god or a mythical figure. It's the story of a man on a mission.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe inevitable when there's a marathon involved.
Right, and she also brings up, is it Pheidippides?
I don't know how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
Pheidippides?
There's only one Greek name I know how to pronounce, and that's Strombolopoulos. Yeah, so like she does bring up Pheidippides, let's say, who ran the original marathon, which was like to and from or from and to the city of Marathon, died at the end of it. So the fact that Terry Fox died after his, you know, 140 or so marathons.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're gonna make this connection to the specific guy, if nothing else.
Yeah, foreshadowing.
My perception on heroes in general is be wary of the concept of heroes.
Yeah.
And I think some of the stuff we'll get to in a bit is going to really feed into why I feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
I do have one kind of funny production note, which is there's the scene where they're playing basketball. Mm-hmm. This is also like a big motif across these episodes, I think, because in the Deborah Gray's Pit for Wayne Gretzky, she's playing street hockey with some kids. And Sukhyun Lee is playing basketball with some people. You have to have stuff happening, I guess. You just got to throw in some action scenes.
Yeah.
When you're talking about like what it's like to be a teenager, and there's this shot where they have her shoot a basket, you know, like she has to give a long unbroken line read to the camera and then like take a pass and go take a shot. So understandably, you use filmmaking techniques to film her taking the shot and then cut to the ball going through the hoop.
Yeah.
And people can watch this, or I'll put it in the video version if people want to have their own look at it. It looks to me like they linger enough to show that she has shot like a clear air ball. It just does not have the momentum to get within like a meter of the net, I want to say.
Yeah.
That sense of motion you have when you watch a movie went like, no, that was a miss. And then you watch, you go to the...
I did not pick that up, but given my incredible ineptitude when it comes to any sport involving a ball, it's not surprising I didn't notice that.
I don't know if they do a little movie magic for this, because... she goes to like the mile zero in St. John's, right? And she talks about how he dipped his foot into the ocean symbolically and took some ocean water and started his run across the country because he was going to dump one of the bottles into the other ocean and dip his foot into that ocean. That was sort of the symbology of it. And in this episode, she also goes and like dips a toe in the water. And so at that mile zero, there is a statue. I went and visited that statue when I went to St. John's last year. This is the photo I have sent you. So I don't know if you have noticed what I'm getting at here. I don't know if they had to do camera tricks in 2005 or if this has happened since then.
I mean, there's a restricted area and a fence.
Yeah, there's a fence. You can't get to the water from there. In 2025, you could not get to the water. Because I went to the statue and I was like, oh, yeah, I could go touch the water. Nope, there's a big shipyard there. You can see the ships in this photo that I took. And there's a fence the whole way across this park. You cannot get to the water. So score another point against nostalgia there.
Yeah.
She also mentions in this is a part where I'm not sure, because I can't say either way whether this is true. She makes this point that before the run, cancer was something that was supposed to be kind of kept in the dark, and that he refused to hide that his leg was prosthetic, that he talked openly about it. So he brought cancer to the forefront. And as though this was a sort of watershed moment in public perception. I don't know if that stuck out to you. It's kind of, I don't know how you can prove that right or wrong. Like, how do you measure awareness? Can you say that somebody really changed the narrative on our awareness of cancer or the need for research? What did you think of that?
This really caught my attention, actually. And I went, oh, that's interesting. A little bit of big if true. I think possibly also because I spend far too much time watching Call the Midwife, which is set in the like 50s, 60s, 70s in East London. And cancer does come up from time to time because it's a broader medical show than just babies. And yeah, it's in that show treated. It's talked about, but it's not a big public thing. Like, everyone knows cancer exists, but that's about it. And so I did a highly detailed piece of research. I asked my parents, and they did agree that up until around maybe 70s, it wasn't something that was talked about much. And I also found an article, which I will send you after this. I mean, I guess the other thing that gets lost in a lot of these narratives is there's not a cancer.
Yeah.
There's hundreds, thousands of different types of cancer. And, you know, yes. Some of them we've almost treated already, others not so much. And, mm-hmm. you know, anytime it's like, oh, well, you know, big pharma's hiding the cure for cancer. It's like, well, no, there's not one cure for a billion and one cancers. Okay, hyperbole, but yeah. Thousands of different cancers. Anyway, the first organizations to set up to fundraise for cancer awareness were in the late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Then it doesn't really say anything else about achievements up until President Nixon declaring a war on cancer in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously by 1971, cancer was talked about enough for President Nixon to declare possibly the only war I would actually support and,
right.
and go and fight in.
But once again, a war that we are not winning, but...
I think we're doing better on the war on cancer than most other wars, to be perfectly honest.
No, that's very true. We have made very tangible progress. I mean, even I think the cancer that Terry Fox has, there's mention of like its treatment had improved in the years like around when he got it. Like
yeah.
I think it was a kind of thing where it would have been more fatal to him something like 10 years before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm remembering this offhand, but there was yeah. something along those lines like,
right at the very end, they do mention that today it's a lot more treatable than it was when Terry had it.
Right, yeah. So there's a kid named Callie, appropriately enough, who they say this kid has lost his leg. And this is like a 2005 mm-hmm. teenager.
Yeah.
She says in it that his cancer is gone. It shows no signs of coming back.
Yeah.
And that is a thing that, again, I'm not an oncologist, but as I understand cancer is... Like, even the idea that you are cured, she emphasizes the word cured, is kind of a misconception. Because once you have been diagnosed and you go into remission, you are always playing games of percentages, right?
Yeah.
There's always a non-zero chance it will come back.
Mm-hmm.
Your chance of, not relapsing, but mm-hmm. your chance of your cancer returning is higher, even if you've gone full remission, there's no traces of cancer in your body.
Mm-hmm.
The chances of it coming to you again is higher than like the median person who's never had it,
yeah.
as I understand, right?
Yeah, that's how I understand it too. And I think there's a really good XKCD cartoon about it.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking of, yeah.
Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know, what's his name? Randall Monroe, the guy who draws the XKCD webcomic, his partner, I believe, got cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a bunch of web comics about this, and in his way did really interesting visual representations. And I think the metaphor is like a highway with all these turnoffs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really beautiful representation of, you can't say that somebody just like doesn't have cancer or definitely, like, I mean, you can say when someone definitely has it, but yeah, like remission is a state of, it's not there right now.
Yeah.
You have improved. Cause I think, I mean, we don't have access to Terry Fox's medical charts, but at the time that he had his leg amputated, from what I gather from this episode, from the reading I've done in the last few days, there was not an indication that cancer was still in his body, right? So if you mm-hmm. had yeah. talked to him as he was training for this run, you might have said the exact same thing you said about the kid in
yeah.
the at the end of the episode, which is, well, he's been cured. Like, he had to get his leg amputated, but the cancer is gone. And then two or three, yeah, something like 3 years after he has the surgery to remove his leg, is when they catch that it's returned in his lungs.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could find out anything, it would be, hey, what happened to this kid that she points out mm-hmm. in this 20-year-old TV episode? Did he ever get cancer again? I would love to know, but we just don't.
Yeah. I mean, I hope not, but
yeah. No, that, to be clear.
I think actually, though, one of the things that they've got better at is knowing that and keeping the monitoring up.
Mm-hmm.
We're jumping around a bit again, but there's this sort of, you know, he was avoiding doctors narrative, and it's like, well, maybe don't do that.
Right, right.
But, you know, at the same time, were they doing annual checkups or anything like that? Because like, that's definitely something that most people who've been through some sort of cancer treatment get regular checkups for a long time
mm-hmm.
to see if it comes back quickly.
When it comes to the portrayal of like Terry Fox as a person, for example, there were, I think, at least two kind of biopics made of him. And his parents, I think, didn't like the first one because it portrayed The arguments he was having with his driver, it portrayed him as a bit temperamental.
Mm-hmm.
And even as it kind of sneaks into what she's saying, like she presents kind of stubbornness at the beginning
mm-hmm.
as a positive.
Yeah.
It sounded like he was a bit stubborn about going and getting checked.
Yeah.
In terms of like he was very stubborn with just his well-being through this run. And that was one of the criticisms he faced was like, this isn't good for you. Like he had, I think, some like stress fractures in his ankle, his like remaining ankle.
Yeah.
As he was getting deep into this run, like this was very, very hard on his body. And
yeah,
it's wildly speculative to say like, oh, he could have caught this earlier. He was actually like, you know, maybe he died because he was getting checked out. That's like so far outside of our wheelhouse. But
yeah. Yeah. We can't know that. We absolutely can't. Mm-hmm. And maybe they would have known earlier but not been able to do anything about it. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to go back to that, the state of cancer treatment in 1981.
Yeah. But I do think that is interesting in terms of we are critiquing this as a narrative is we're kind of leaving out some of those things that maybe are relevant, which is someone being a bit stubborn,
mm-hmm.
a bit temperamental. What are the imperfect sides of this story that merit our consideration?
Yeah. There's quite a lot of those. Like I wasn't familiar with the other biopics, like so not knowing that, you know, there were times when he'd been stroppy or whatever. But one thing that really struck me is that he's not running with a backpack. He's not running with a water bottle. There's got to be someone in a car following along with his suitcase and whatever. Probably someone planning out logistics. Probably, you know, people doing publicity and all of that sort of thing. But because this is a hagiography of Terry Fox, none of them get even a slightest mention.
Do they not mention the driver in this episode?
I didn't pick up maybe on it not. At all, no.
And it is very, very well covered in usually when somebody writes a piece about him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm having trouble keeping him all straight because, you know, I'm reading several different news articles and his Wikipedia and you're mm-hmm. reading all this, but that is something that comes up is that he had this driver. The driver was a friend of the family or something, I believe. And like, mm-hmm. he got into a lot of very like tense, I think, arguments with the driver because it was just like a very, I mean, this is like a high emotion thing,
you know,
supporting this person. So no, for sure. Like they had, the van was following him the whole time. It became mm-hmm. a sort of like motorcade and obviously he's sleeping, I think sometimes in this van, sometimes sleeping in hotels. So he's always has these supports around him. And definitely in real life, I don't think there was any shyness around that. It's just, it doesn't quite maybe fit into the narrative that they are telling in this in this episode.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it is specifically the greatest Canadian. It's not the greatest Canadian and his support team.
That's true. Yeah.
Even then, I think the story they're telling about him, you think he'd acknowledge his support team at some point, but maybe they just cut that a bit. I don't know.
It's tough to say. I didn't extremely get the impression that, I mean, maybe I just knew too much going in.
Yeah.
I knew so much about the whole, like, the logistics of how his team was going with him that I never got the impression from this episode that they were trying to bury that, but it's hard to see it with fresh eyes.
And I mean, I don't necessarily know that they buried it, rather that the narrative was laser focused on Terry.
Yeah.
So
yeah, yeah.
They ended up leaving the rest out. But that was definitely something I noticed.
Speaking of laser focus, this was one other just kind of actual television craft thing that I noticed. But I don't know if you caught this, but toward the conclusion when she's walking through Bangalore again,
mm-hmm.
it's made me kind of think I should watch for this more when someone is doing this kind of, I'm just walking through a street production when sometimes, like, if you're trying to stage that sort of thing, like, everything is set up. You have extras walking around.
Mm-hmm.
They're clearly just filming themselves as she rides a bike through Bangalore because all of the locals will just turn their heads and stare directly into the camera because they're doing this thing of, like, hey, what's happening here? What are these people up to? You can't unnotice it when you see it because it's, like, four people in a row just turn their heads to stare directly in the barrel of the camera as she rolls by. It's just fun.
To be honest, I didn't notice that either.
Yeah, I only noticed it in my last watch.
So when we were talking about the cancer being, you know, spoken behind closed doors, the other thing that came up was that he was not shy about having a prosthetic leg,
mm-hmm.
which I found interesting because that's another thing that has improved massively since 1980,
right,
is the quality of prostheses. But for a long time, they did try and make them look like body parts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a friend of mine has prosthetic legs, and all through high school, she had pinkish beige prosthetics with, I think she had painted toenails on it at one point.
Oh, okay.
But she also had like a fixed ankle that did mean she struggled with mobility and with like slopes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you compare a leg like that, which looks normalish from a distance, to, you know, something like the blade legs that runners use.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like once you move away from it looking like a leg, you actually potentially get a lot more utility out of it. And obviously that's a massive oversimplification. It's a very complex area.
Yeah.
And, you know, if people want to look normal, go for it. Like, I'm not judging that. What even is normal?
But if you want to run across a country, you'd probably want a more utilitarian leg than
you
had.
Yeah. If you want to run across a country, you probably want a blade that means you don't have to do that hopping shuffle.
Because, I mean, the idea of doing athletics as an amputee is not unique, right? I mean,
yeah.
We have the Paralympics. I think they just would have ended.
Yeah.
So you can watch how do people run in these competitions. And yeah, they would have more of these like blade legs, springy things. Certainly what he's working with in 1981 is not optimized for running, which just goes to show, like, I can't stress this enough, the actual accomplishment in a vacuum of running as far as he did.
Yeah.
Right. What is that? 5,373 kilometers
mm-hmm.
on this like shuffle on a leg that is not well suited to this, that is like giving him bone bruises in his stump. Like it's mind blowing that he was able to do this. I cannot like overemphasize this part.
Just watching hurts.
Yeah.
I've had my fair share of injuries and walked on them and things like that, but good grief, that hurts to watch.
Yeah. Well, and they mentioned this too, like blood is seeping into the shorts. Like it's really just a grind.
And then you sort of go, okay, well, maybe he deserves a hagiography then, because that is, you know, just the determination
mm-hmm.
and stubbornness that requires is something else. That also made me think, because there's also a bit near the beginning,
mm-hmm.
they talk about loving the underdog. And then the next thing she says is something about an ice hockey player playing on with an injury.
Okay, let's face it. Canadians love the underdog. I mean, we'll rave on and on about the hockey player who stays in the game with a broken ankle and shoots and scores. But you know what? That doesn't hold a candle to my guy. Not even close.
And I'm like, that's not the underdog. That's an idiot.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of the story of Kerry Strug, which was came up a lot when Simone Biles took her break from competing. Kerry Strug was an American gymnast who injured herself during the vault. Her coach was sort of going, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. And she did go back and do her second vault mm-hmm. and collapsed in agony afterwards. Like she landed it and then immediately collapsed in agony and tears. And for a long time, this was a story about how she, you know, she overcame the injury. She pushed through and took the gold. And, you know, when you look at it again, it's like, why did she vault on an injured leg?
Right.
Part of the reason the story really stuck with me is that I came across a Facebook post written by a dad who, when he was a kid, saw this and thought, oh, yeah, that's really tough. Go, girl. And then as an adult with his daughters in gymnastics, he was like, what? No, she should not have vaulted again. She should not have been pushed. You know, yes, she maybe did want to push and maybe it was her choice, but, you know, her coach was egging her on. Given everything else we know about gymnastics programs, she was probably not being treated super well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in those sports, you have coaches egging you on is a huge, huge part of it.
Yeah. In other stories, it goes even worse, because there was a Russian gymnast who similarly was injured and was basically forced to compete while she wasn't fully healed. And she did an incredibly dangerous move that has now been banned because of how dangerous it was. And she under-rotated because she was still recovering from an injury. And landed on her neck and died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, that's not the underdog. That's not cheering someone on for pushing through, that's criminal, basically, that her coach has forced her to compete.
Yeah.
You know, thankfully for the US gymnasts that, you know, she didn't have that level of injury. And even better for Simone Biles, she was able to turn around and go, nah, I need to stop.
Mm-hmm.
She's the best gymnast of all time. But I think actually as a message of doing the tough thing goes, I think actually her choice to step back and take a break and say no is probably actually A, the strongest thing she's done,
mm-hmm.
bravest thing she's done, and the best thing she could do for every young gymnast that comes after her. And I mean, like, yeah, Terry Fox was a grown man. There wasn't a coach pushing him on. There was people actually saying to him, like, come on, dude, like, take it easy. You're bleeding. Yeah. What the hell?
There was a quote from his mom
mm-hmm.
where she said, he told me and I discouraged him out the gate
mm-hmm.
and that she felt guilt later over being, she was saying, I'm paraphrasing her here, but she was saying, I should have been the first person to encourage him and I was the first person to let him down.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is her being unfair to herself of like,
yeah.
if you're very, like, yeah, grown adult, but he was 22, very mm-hmm. young adult son, he says, I'm going to run across the country.
On one leg.
Like, it is understandable that you might be like, slow your roll a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't want to go off more than what they said in this episode of mm-hmm. like, he was kind of shrugging off doctors. He was a bit stubborn about being seen. Again, we don't want to speculate on what he could have done different, but we do have parallel examples. Like in your gymnast example, as you were telling that example, it reminded me of this comes up, unsurprisingly, in hockey culture, right?
Yeah.
This idea of playing through toughness. That was the example Sukhin Lee gives in this episode of,
yeah.
of playing through injury is like, it's inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a cool story when you read in a vacuum that somebody won the Stanley Cup and they had like a broken leg. Like, people will do this shit. It's insane.
Yeah.
It sounds cool when it happens. But the reason that I do think it's worth talking about in this Terry Fox context is we can't know the specifics of what would have happened if he had done certain things differently. But we can say, what does telling the story in this way,
yeah.
what message does that send to people, especially young people who are out there engaging in risky behavior and mm-hmm. behavior that is damaging to their bodies. One example that happened recently in hockey, this happened to my team, the Oilers, with Evander Kane, who does not deserve a hagiography. He is a bad person, but he was playing through a sports hernia, right? Which is mm-hmm. a specific, very specific kind of hernia that like you just need to get a surgery for it.
Yeah.
And he was injured around like New Year's or something. And then he was playing like hurt for a while, intermittently sitting and just being really ineffective. And it was like playing injured until they finally just pulled him off
mm-hmm.
during the Stanley Cup Finals, which they lost in June. And I mean, when you look at the timeline, it's like if you had gotten this surgery in January, just stopped as soon as you were injured, got the surgery and recovered for 3 or 4 months and come back to start the playoffs,
yeah.
you would have helped your team.
Mm.
And so there's all these examples of like, it is genuinely, no, you shouldn't have done that. You should not have played through injury. That was stupid.
Yeah. And generally don't avoid doctors.
Yeah.
Sometimes that can be annoying know-it-alls and there's certain screening things that, okay, I've talked myself into it. I'll go to do the screening thing I've been avoiding. Yeah.
But especially if you have a history of cancer, yeah. don't avoid doctors because it might be coming back.
Yes. I mean, we don't know, but
yeah,
yeah. There's something in the way the story is being told that it's like, is that really the message we wanted to give about what makes someone a hero?
Mm-hmm. We can transition to these notes that I wrote. I want to bridge that by bringing it back to what you were saying about asking your parents, like,
mm-hmm.
was there a difference in how people talked about cancer before versus now?
Yeah.
And I think there is another, everyone's favorite correlation causation issue
mm-hmm.
where... sure, the narrative has changed over time. And I mean, the advancements in cancer research have come, but how much causation can we draw there?
Yeah.
For one thing, like examples where we can't prove causation, but also who are the other people that we aren't talking about that also helped change the narrative, that also drove innovation, like making it kind of a great man theory thing, right? Is a bit of an issue.
Yeah. Like there's never a great man in medical research. Really?
Yeah, I think it's a really good way of putting it is that the fallacy we have in taking this really cool story, again, great story.
Mm-hmm.
The bare bones of what he did is so cool. And how can that narrative be turned toward ends that I don't agree with. Mm. And I think it is through this process of this gray man theory of medical research. I think that's a very snappy way to put it. Here's what I found. I did a little bit of homework on this. I didn't intend to do a bit of homework, but I kind of fell into a hole with this. So on its website, the Terry Fox Foundation, which is an entire charitable foundation that exists today that stems directly from this original Marathon of Hope, right? On their website, the Terry Fox Foundation claims in one spot that the Terry Fox run has raised over $850 million since 1981. I'm going to assume that's Canadian dollars. In another spot on the same website, they claim $900 million, which is like probably just sloppy web design.
Yeah.
Their website is used in a Wikipedia citation because there's no dates on the Terry Fox Foundation website.
Oh, yeah.
Whoever wrote this Wikipedia article used that number of $850 million for May of 2022. So I kind of feel like if I'm trying to piece together what happened with this website, they wrote in $850 million. They put in $900 million a little bit later, but probably still not up to date for 2025 or six, right?
Yeah.
The great thing about this being an NGO is that they have all their financials online. So I took the liberty of looking through their financials.
Oh, yeah.
So when you look at their total fundraising revenue across those 3 years, post-2022, because the 2026 is not, they all come out in like March 31st, and we're recording this on, what is it, March
6th.
March 6th today? So we don't quite have the 2026 numbers out, but for 2023, 4, 5, across those 3 years, they claim nearly $100 million in total fundraising revenue, right? So there's different phrases being employed, but I think when they say, we raised this much, you're talking about fundraising revenue, right? So I think that as of the end of the last year that they report for, I'm going to generously say that it's probably something more like $950 million as of 2025, right? Yeah, we don't quite have the 2026 numbers, but if we want to compare another 2025 thing, just to put that number in perspective, right? Because when you say that on its own, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
But what is 900 odd million bucks? In the 2025 Canadian federal budget, per the CBC, quote, the federal government proposes providing $925.6 million over the next 5 years to support a large-scale sovereign public AI infrastructure, end quote.
Oh.
Yeah. So we are roughly comparing 5 years, 900-some million dollars for AI, 44 years, 900 some million dollars raised by this thing. So
yeah,
but there's like a few caveats, right? This is a, we don't want to directly compare these numbers exactly because over that period of time, the foundation's revenues have trended up over time. So recent years have made much more than earlier years. I have no idea how they're running those totals. Like when you say this is $850 million, how does the inflation of 1981 dollars compare to today?
Yeah.
So we can set aside the math of doing 44 years worth of comparisons and stick with the recent numbers, which are the most generous toward the foundation. I also want to get away from this comparison of expenditure, which was that the government example I gave, compared to the main source of fundraising, right? Your expenditures are different from your revenues. So what we should be comparing, and again, this is a problem I have with the framing of the charity itself saying this is how much we've raised is, okay, but how much are you spending? That is a much more direct comparison to something like a government budget, because it's always going to be, well, not necessarily less, but let's break down the numbers.
Hello, listener, and welcome to the Midreel ad. If you enjoy Canuck is a Slur, a podcast about Canadian culture, and you want to hear more of it more often, there is an option. The Canuck is a Slur Patreon. Signing up at any tier gets you access to
Give Kelly Your Money.
And joining an elevated tier gets you access to monthly bonus episodes. If that sounds good, you can sign up at www.patreon.com/Canuck is a Slur. And now, back to the episode.
So strictly from fundraising, the foundation claimed about $39.4 million in 2025. And that's their best year of the years they have online. If you add investment income and merchandise sales, it's actually about $48.7 million in gross revenue. But if you take away about $6.3 million in fundraising expenses, $4.6 million in administrative costs, and $1.4 million in merchandise costs,
Mm-hmm.
You're down to more like $36.3 million in what's listed as excess revenue, right? This is a nonprofit, so they're not making profit. They have excess revenue.
Yeah.
But that's $36 million that you could theoretically spend on cancer research or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the actual amount that the foundation dispensed in 2025 was only about $31.7 million. That leaves about $4.6 million left over until you get to their cash flow section, where most of that remainder was eaten up by what's listed as investment income reinvested.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting money from investment income, but they also have to spend money reinvesting. And the foundation actually ended the year with $2 million less in cash than they started.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of simplify what those numbers mean, if we look at them spending $31.7 million on actual dispensation, the federal government spends nearly six times that much for 1 year of AI bullshit.
Yeah. Did you manage to come across, and, you know, no pressure if you didn't, because this was a random last minute bit of research, how much the government puts in to cancer research?
Not exactly.
Because this is another thing when it comes to medical research and especially like big complex projects and things like that, is a lot of the money does still come from the state.
Well, yeah. So to answer your question directly, I don't have the exact numbers that the government spent on cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to pull a few different things. Like I was trying to see like how much potentially the Canadian government had sent to Israel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that stuff is like arms sales. So it's, again, not a good comparison.
Yeah.
I was trying to see just like in terms of military spending, like if I was American, I would just be like, let's compare the funds raised by cancer research to like the cost mm-hmm. of a single F-35, right? Right. Or a single Tomahawk missile.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, how much money does the state spend on cancer research is a great question that I would like to revisit at some point. I would like to take an even deeper dive into these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But I pulled these numbers just to kind of make a general illustration about what I think is missing in the narrative of this person went out, whether that's running across the country or going and skating a bunch of laps. If those funds were worth taking from each Canadian, why don't we just levy a tax on it? Which is not a fun and inspiring question. But so to use that example of Terry Fox wanted to raise $1 for every person in Canada, if you taxed each person, I mean, obviously, like babies don't pay taxes, but if you tax each taxpayer the equivalent to have a dollar for every person in Canada, this kind of cut out some middlemen.
Yeah.
Buried in those numbers was just on the cost of fundraising, meaning the cost you incur in getting people to give you money.
Yeah.
That was $6.3 million in fundraising expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the way a government works, which is you already have a tax infrastructure. You already have to levy taxes, enforce them, decide how much they're going in. These are all sunk costs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you were to take the same amount from people directly in taxes and not have to have an entire NGO structure just to convince people to give you the money voluntarily, you're going to get more cents on the dollar into the cancer research any way you slice it.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point. In fact, while you were talking, I found the Cancer Research UK spending summary. They have some nice visuals, so I might send them to you. And, you know, again, like 22% of what is raised goes to fundraising costs.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's 22%. That's a lot of pounds when you add it all up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the answer is, because sometimes I'm skeptical of the state as well. And, you know, I think everyone can probably say that right at the moment, I don't trust the state to spend it on things that aren't missiles, but yeah.
I mean, I am an anarchist leading person. I am not a big lover of the state, but in the current context we have, the state exists.
Yeah.
And yeah, you need to have states with structures of accountability to say, where is this money going? And maybe some of the money is people having a voice and saying, I would rather fund cancer research than fund Tomahawk missiles. But the thing is, as much as I don't necessarily trust the state, I don't necessarily trust an NGO, because who is keeping the NGOs accountable? One of the very famous examples that we might talk about it at some point, but it was already covered very well in the podcast series, The White Saviors, which was put on by formerly good, but now unfortunately pro-Israel outlet Canada Land. But this, if you go, it's like a 5 or 6 part series, and it's about the We Charity scandal. And to save anyone time who hasn't listened to it, there was huge doubts over, like, was this charity doing fuck all, basically, right?
Yeah.
And this was a charity that was very much in bed with the government. Everyone loved it. They were media darlings. And it was like a lot of this charity was going like fucking real estate and all these like very sketchy, not private-public partnerships, but like social enterprise, right? Saying that, oh, actually, charity would be more efficient if for-profit companies are allowed to do it. And it just like, it's, again, I don't want to summarize it because there's a very good series on it. And if we cover it at some point, we'll cover it more properly.
Yeah.
But like a charity can be corrupt too.
Yeah.
Or just inefficient. Mm-hmm. But when you already have a state structure that, as you point out, is already very invested in cancer research, I don't think adding parallel structures of NGOs is any more efficient. You're just adding more people who need to sit on a board and collect a salary to sit on a board.
Mm.
But I have some more numbers, so we'll actually get a little more into the structure of my point. Now, if we take the Terry Fox Foundation, and we compare their actual donated total, which is both to cancer research and other, with non-specific other, if we presume that anything they are donating or dispensing is going to a good cause, if we compare that total to their initial fundraising number, it means that for every dollar raised, and remember, this is the number that they're boasting, I found about 80 cents actually goes to dispensation, right? Which is very close to what you were giving about like the 78 pence on the pound.
Yeah.
But yeah, to give you an idea, when the Terry Fox Foundation in particular says we have raised this many dollars, based on their own financials for 2025, they actually dispensed 80 cents on the dollar for what they raised, right? After all of the machinations in and out, right?
Yeah.
The black and the red on the balance sheet. But then there's a question of what happens to those 80 cents dispensed? So there's another fun wrinkle here. The number that I gave for what they gave out was $31.7 million, right?
Yeah.
Out of that, $1.2 million went to what's listed as international cancer research organizations, and under $700,000 went to other distributions and charitable activities, right? None of those are specified, but that is, again, a total of about 6% of this. The lion's share, the 94%, which is $29.8 million, went to the Terry Fox Institute. So the Terry Fox Foundation is giving 94% of its $31.7 million to the Terry Fox Institute. So what is the Terry Fox Institute? Do they do research?
I hope so. I really hope so.
Are they working on treatments and cures? Well, one of the main things they do, because I went to their website and I went to their mission statement, their financials and everything. One of the main things that they do is they donate to places doing the actual work, right?
Okay.
This is a thing that I didn't like maybe have a fully formed idea in my head is, what does paying for research mean?
Yeah.
The answer is essentially paying a researcher for the work that they do. Who does that work? By and large, it's universities.
Yeah.
So in the case of some of the examples I checked on the Terry Fox Institute website, a lot of them go to the University of British Columbia. Not all of them, but definitely a lot of them. It seems to be a big cancer research university. Some of them go to more nebulous sounding places like the BC Cancer Research Institute. I looked into that because I was like, oh God, is this another layer of abstraction? From their website, I got the impression, I'm not an expert, that they still employ researchers.
Yeah.
Right? So they're probably roughly parallel to a university. So fair enough, right? So that is part of where the Terry Fox Institute directs its money. Now, again, it is not, from what I can see, paying researchers to do research, but it is donating to these institutions that do it, right? That is sort of the end of point. If you are paying a scientist to work in a lab, that is where the money theoretically becomes advancement. But that is part of where the institute directs its money. Also, according to their website, it's, quote, investment expands beyond our flagship basic science and translational research programs. With support from partners across the country, including the Government of Canada, we now lead two innovative projects that embody Terry Fox's spirit and unite our country to improve the lives of cancer patients through precision medicine, the Marathon of Hope Cancer Centers Network, and the Digital Health and Discovery Platform.
That's a lot of words.
It is a lot of words. We have now introduced another node of, okay, straight up government funding. So the government is already involved in this funding.
Well, so that's good. They're not spending that on themselves.
Right. But again, my contention is if the government is already involved in the cancer research funding, why are we having to split it between them and the institutions?
Yeah, no, I do see where you're coming from on that.
But then what are these two institutions they listed? So we have the Terry Fox Foundation, the Terry Fox Institute, and then on another lower level, the Marathon of Hope Cancer Centers Network. And this other one, the Digital Health and Discovery Platform. So I looked at both of those to see what those are and what are they doing. So the Digital Health and Discovery Platform on its website makes such tangible and clear claims as that it is, quote, creating a framework to accelerate precision medicine in Canada, end quote, and, quote, developing substantial policy innovations, end quote, and that, quote, it is designed to create world-leading policy and technology stacks, end quote.
That's a lot of words.
It is unequivocally words. You cannot deny that that is words.
See, because like when I first heard the name of it, I thought that it might be something along the lines of there's a few organizations we have here, like there's the Administrative Data Research UK, and there's something called Open Safely. And they're both platforms where they have masses of health data, administrative data. So basically like GP records, hospital records, and things like that. And they've got them all linked together. But, you know, they do it in a safe, secure way where you can't know who anyone is. Specifically, the second one I mentioned, the Open Safely, like researchers don't even ever touch the data. They get given like synthetic data. And when I heard the name, I was like, oh, okay, maybe it's one of these like giant data platforms that links data together and actually does some really interesting and useful research out of it while keeping it secure. Then you went into the description of it and I went, what?
Yeah.
There was a lot of words. I understood individually what each of them meant, but
yeah,
I know people that work in policy and that doesn't sound like anything.
I would definitely encourage somebody who is a little more immersed in, for example, these fields of public policy that can maybe actually parse out this group better. But because again, this should be parallel in the structure where, or this should be on the same kind of level of the org chart. The Terry Fox Institute is directly, yeah, they say flagship basic science and translational research programs. So that's them giving money to people doing the work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that is that last layer of abstraction.
Yeah.
Now, something that should nominally be as effective if they're going to do it instead is donating to this group. But it is not an amazing sales pitch. I think it might be similar to what you're describing because I think there was some stuff on the website about like the actual data handling. And like, in fairness, like that is something that obviously is often lost on a lay person, where they're like, where's all this money going? It's like, you can't even imagine the layers to what research entails, right?
Yeah.
It's not all pipettes and lab coats.
Yeah.
It is stuff like handling data, but
if it is something like that, then yeah, it is actually incredibly useful.
Mm-hmm.
However, maybe they do need to spend a little bit of that money on a comms professional who can explain it on their website.
Yeah. Or maybe they're spending, unfortunately, too much money on their comms professional who's
bad at the job.
Yeah. Like what I really would like to convey is that like obviously handling all of like this data aggregation stuff is just as much a part of it as every other aspect of the research.
Mm-hmm.
But I question to what extent the way all of this is structured is the most efficient way to do like what is the signal to noise ratio in doing crucial work versus layers and layers of org charts.
Yeah.
And donations upon donations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, the first layer of this we talked about was getting 80% of the value of what comes in going out.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't say for sure that the next layer down, the Institute, is working at 80% efficiency, but it's not 100.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, each layer is going to have a payroll person. And don't get me wrong, you need a payroll person and you need admin roles. Like we don't have enough HR.
Right. But each one of these places needs its own payroll person when they are separate entities.
Yeah. And that seems potentially inefficient.
And again, I would like to, in the future, go into this in a more comprehensively broken down way. I just wanted to start with this level of it. And because we're not done, because we talked about the Digital Health and Discovery Platform. Again, in what is presented as equivalent to that in terms of we're spending money on funding the research directly, we are spending money on this platform, which could be fantastic what it does, and then the Marathon of Hope Cancer Center's network. So what is that? Well, it claims to be, quote, investing in key areas that will help accelerate precision medicine for cancer, end quote, and that it, quote, uses experts to review projects and determine their potential for impact, end quote. Their founding president proudly proclaims, quote, our goal is to create the Team Canada of cancer research so we can work together to improve the lives of our cancer patients, end quote. So at minimum, one of the main things this further layer of NGOs is claiming to do is invest.
Yeah.
Not giving money to research, it is another layer of investment.
Well, see, the way I heard that was that they're a kind of grant screening body. But have we now got three layers of bureaucracy?
Yeah, so I have a summary for this.
Yeah.
If every Canadian donates a dollar to the Terry Fox Foundation, the foundation will give 80 cents to the Terry Fox Institute, which will give some amount of money to two other NGOs, which will in turn develop policy innovations and invest in key areas, and give some amount of money to universities doing research, while our federal and provincial governments are broadly cutting the funding of those universities at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's one of the biggest issues I have right now is that, because again, this is what is on the Terry Fox Institute's website when you actually look at a specific project, because they break it down. This one is about brain cancer. This one's about lung cancer. And they say, this is who we're giving it to. And across the board, it is basically a university or an equivalent body, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have to go from me to the foundation, to the institute, to a university at best. And then by the time you get to the level of the institute, they're already saying we are partnered with the federal government to fund our this discovery platform and the Cancer Centers Network.
Yeah.
So I really question why it is, for one thing, I can't save some energy by taking my dollar and giving it straight to the University of British Columbia, or at least giving it to the government in its existing tax structure to give it to those universities directly. I just really am struggling to see how it needs to go through so many hands before it reaches a university at the same time as, like, this is an actual issue that is happening in academia right now, is universities are getting choked out as we speak. It is happening in, like, every province in Canada. For example, because we talked about that 2025 federal budget, which is where that, you know, AI funding I invoked is coming from. So where I'm staying right now, which is with a friend and host of the show, Nicole. So her husband, who works not in cancer research, he works in seismology, but he was just applying for a job that is back in Canada. He was excited about this job. And that job offer fell through because that program had its funding cut from the most recent federal budget. I don't think things are necessarily that different in cancer. I think this is only more true at a time when everyone's saying, well, what are we funding universities for? It's like, well, this is the thing you love so much is cancer research. If you're trying to tighten our belts, maybe we need to cut off some of this bloat and give money directly to universities.
Yeah.
So something I also want to note in this context is that a lot of these places on these websites lean heavily on the branding of Terry Fox, right? It's not just like in the header, in the name. They have these beautifully designed websites that say like Terry's story. Both the Terry Fox Institute and the Marathon of Hope Cancer Centers Network use this big splash image. I'll put it in the video version. This huge splash of Terry jogging down the road with gigantic text reading, finish it, as in finish the run, right?
Yeah.
I mean, my question is here, how many rounds of fundraising until it's finished?
Yeah. Because it was funny when you read out some of the text a few minutes ago, there was something about continuing Terry Fox's legacy of, it seems to really be embedded in the story of this fundraising.
I mean, I'm sure there is one of these many terms for it, right? We have our greenwashing and our pinkwashing and our whatever. Like, this is, to me, charity washing when I think we should be asking questions of how are we allocating our resources as a society that wants to fund things. And these groups are able to use this dead person as a form of marketing to say, no, we're good because we are part of this legacy. When I want to be very fair again to Terry Fox, the person who was 21 years old when he started running across the country, right?
Yeah.
When he said he wants to raise money for cancer research, I don't expect him to have a deeper, more complicated idea of what does funding it mean? Because when I was 21, I didn't know fuck all, right?
No. Absolutely not.
But we as the people who are still around today, I think it becomes irresponsible to use this 21-year-old's branding, mm-hmm. his image, to say, you need to fund us because we're the ones funding cancer. And I'm like, I mean, the university are the people who are actually making advancements, these various institutions. Mm-hmm. This discussion to me has been totally lost of, like, how do we actually fund research?
Yeah, and there's so much stuff around fundraising more generally that can get very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. The one that really got me lately was there's an organization called Medical Aid for Palestinians, which I've had a standing donation to for the last few years. And I got an email from them recently going, a donor has said that they'll match the next $50,000 of, or, you know, it was like some big sum. I can't remember exactly what. And so basically I get an email from this charity saying, donate now and a backer will match your donation up to £50,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here going like, why don't they just give the £50,000?
Yes, right.
And I mean, yes, okay, maybe it's a way they were always going to give 50,000 and they just want to get other people giving more. But it's like, I've worked out my budget and I know how much I can afford to give to charity each month, and I give that much to charity each month. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this idea of saying, I'll give this money if other people do, it just feels gross.
Yeah. Like, there's different kinds of fundraising. I think that's that's one example where a person says, I've got $50,000 I can give out, but I will only tip it out. Like, if people didn't match it, would they not donate it? If that's the case, that sucks.
Yeah.
But if you were to donate it no matter what, yeah, it is a weird thing to say, like, but you have to donate in order for me to match it. Like, again, yeah, this is my kind of no fun pragmatist opinion, but what is the correct amount that we need to be funding a thing with? And we should be funding it by levying first from the people who can afford it most.
Yeah. I mean, it's always tricky, and I guess you're never going to get agreement from everyone on what is important. And I definitely see where you're coming from, and I don't have all the answers. And then you get weird competitions between charities and things like this. Like, when I was at uni, there was a fundraising newspaper we did, and we were always careful about who we gave grants to, because someone had worked out that, like, I think 90 or 95 cents from every charity dollar given at the time was going to children with cancer from the country. And so we'd try and give to something that wasn't children with cancer from the country. And don't get me wrong, like, children with cancer from the country, that sucks for them. Their parents have to travel to the city where the hospitals are. Like, they definitely deserve support. Mm-hmm. Maybe that support could be coming from the welfare system.
Right.
I don't know.
But it's a similar example to, like, if we're raising money for a homeless shelter, and it's like, well, this would be rendered moot if we were just, the government was paying for housing.
Yeah.
Like, you should be taxing us, but specifically you should be taxing the billionaires so that we can pay for housing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, at a certain point, there is a saturation at which you can actually make more progress with more money in the field of cancer research, because you have a finite number of cancer researchers on Earth, right?
Yeah.
If you can determine what is the amount they need to work at their maximum capacity every year, that's kind of your number, right? And then other money can be used for other things like housing. But that is at least just, I think, the sort of, if nothing else, the statist argument is that by putting your resources into a central pool, you can allocate where they go rather than having a bunch of these independent nodes that are not talking to each other competing for your donations.
Uh-oh, you're not going to turn into an effective altruist, are you? I will come over there and slap you.
No, but what I'm saying is, like, the problem is that these NGOs are forced to effectively compete when, no, I think there needs to be a panel of people in government who just say, like, no, we're going to take the resources and decide where they're allocated from one big pool.
Or even better, like, a jury that's, like, representative of the population.
Well, sure, make it civilian.
I'm going to get so fired for this episode. It's great. I love it.
That's fine. No one's listening. We already know there are structures that are less wasteful. And I should spend more time auditing more charities for comparison. Maybe we'll have, like, a proper charity episode where we can do this, but just from what I've seen from these websites, I was just shocked by the number of layers of abstraction that I have to give money to a foundation, which gives money to an institute, which gives money to several different institutes and also different NGOs to say, like, how is this the most efficient way to split around my dollar?
Yeah.
And this does come up in practicality. So like my nephew, for example, gets into doing the Terry Fox Run stuff. Mm-hmm. And I will say this as a positive application of where fundraising is useful, because if you were to say, like, well, you should never give to charity, all of this stuff should go through the government, right? If the government just taxes your parents and says this is going to cancer research, that doesn't keep you as engaged as a citizen. And I think that if you can get kids interested in something like that, that's positive, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And no, I don't think a child should have to run 5K for my dollar to go somewhere, but I think a kid going out and getting exercise is still a cool thing.
And I think kids getting a sense of achievement is also a good thing.
Yeah. We know we talked about numbers you can measure, like how many cents on the dollar goes to this. But something that is just not quantifiable is, like, what is the value of keeping people aware and keeping people engaged? Because I don't want to say it's nothing, right?
Yeah.
Awareness is a totally real thing, right? If you say I'm running across the country for awareness, like, I think that carries a lot of weight. It can also have its toxic things where we've done so much for breast cancer awareness. Like, this is something that Nicole was just bringing up to me, is like, people have critiqued that as we are now disproportionately funding a, like, lesser occurring cancer because it's this sort of, like, flashy leader in PR.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's the flip side of what I was talking about earlier, is there's not cancer. There are many cancers.
Mm-hmm.
At least the ones that kind of centralize it can go, okay, so we're going to spread out our research into these cancers, and actually 90% of people are surviving breast cancer these days. So maybe we look at this more frequent occurring cancer with a lower survival rate a bit more. And I mean, it's still always a depressing maths when you've got to work out stuff like that.
But I think in terms of practical things we can do, because this is what I was thinking of before we recorded, is this comes up every year. I think it's usually around May, where I get the message from my brother to the family that says, can we all put in some money for his Terry Fox Run? And I think even as just on a citizen level, you can ask questions of, okay, so who is he raising money for? Is it going to the Terry Fox Foundation? If we as a family unit, me, my siblings, parents, in-laws, whatever, raise, I don't know, 200 Canadian dollars, for example, can we say, good on you on raising this from us, where are we going to donate it? And is it more efficient for me to hit up the university donations department and say, can we donate this to the faculty of, like, oncology instead of donating it to this kind of nebulous foundation that, like, may not be getting very much to these universities at all? I think it's an interesting question that people can actually engage with in their real life.
Yeah. No, that is definitely an interesting question. And I mean, I have seen it come up when people are talking about Gaza and stuff like that at the moment. Like I said, I give to a charity that supports people in Gaza. I so far haven't been giving to individual crowdfunders, partly because I just don't have the mental bandwidth to engage in that without becoming, like, catatonically depressed.
Yep.
Or putting my head through the wall out of anger or something. So I'm just like, well, what can I do? Here's a charity. Yes, some of the money probably does go to their fundraising costs and their overheads, but they are doing good work. They're, you know, a regulated charity in the UK. They're, you know, I've checked their accounts, I've checked their, like, what they're doing. I'm on board with it. But yeah, I think there is something in there to go, well, if I'm giving to this organization that does this step, that does this step, that does this step, then yeah, how much of it is actually getting to Gaza?
There's a usefulness in having at least one layer of abstraction of, it is paralyzing and overwhelming for individuals to have to know where to give all their money, but having a organization that knows how to distribute their money effectively is a nice thing to have. And when, like, when the administrative cost is a person doing the actual work of this charity, especially if it's small in scale, like, it's not just about having a C-suite that's, like, paying an absurd salary, but, like, if this is a handful of people that is, like, taking a wage to do this, I'm also okay with paying someone a wage.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
If 90 cents on the dollar goes to Gaza and 10 cents on the dollar goes to paying a good person to do a job, that's no different from me giving money, for example, to someone on Patreon. to do what I think is a good job. That's fine. It's just that, like, when the actual cost of fundraising is so high, it makes me wonder.
Yeah.
It's like, there's got to be a more efficient way of just getting the money from people than to have to spin up all these big to-dos to try to motivate people, right?
I mean, I'd love to just be able to give my entire charity budget to an organization that is, like, that I then voted for where the money went to, or like how it was prioritized or something. But then that meant that a whole bunch of organizations weren't fighting for that money and spending money on advertising and mailers and, you know, things like that.
Yeah, I would like to do some episodes later on maybe breaking down charity in more effective ways and actually maybe even coming up with some answers to these questions.
Yeah, but answers that are not make as much money as possible and invest it in the singularity, because that's the only way to save humanity.
Yeah.
Because again, I will come over and slap you.
Yeah. But yeah, with all of that covered, Kirsty, are you ready for the depressing part?
Sure. Yeah. Wait, we haven't already done that bit?
Oh, no, that's just all the intro banter.
Oh.
Circling back to the very beginning of the pitch episode, the kind of premise is Terry Fox is sort of this globalized brand, right? Not everywhere, certainly in Canada, he's still a household name.
Mm-hmm.
You hadn't heard of Terry Fox. Most Canadians have heard of Terry Fox.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of Steve Fonio?
No.
So this is somebody I had never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
3 years after Terry Fox died, Steve Fonio set out to do the same run as an 18-year-old with the other leg amputated from the exact same cancer.
Okay.
He finished the entire run, coast to coast, east to west, across Canada, in a little over a year and was named to the Order of Canada for his trouble. He also ran north to south across Great Britain later on. According to an article by journalist Scott Radley, quote, he had lunch at George Harrison's house, met Princess Diana and Prince Charles at Buckingham Palace, went out with Miss Canada, chatted on the phone with Ronald Reagan, even had a private audience with the Pope, end quote.
Okay.
Again, never heard of this guy until, I think, yesterday.
Huh.
Yeah, and in the pitch episode, Sukhyun Lee says that Terry Fox was the youngest recipient ever of the Order of Canada. The keyword here was, Fonio was 2 years younger when he got it. I don't know how aware they were when they wrote it, but if I were to write it, I would argue you have to say was, because he is not the youngest person to ever receive it. Now, unfortunately, Fonio's later life was marked by addiction, homelessness, and a number of criminal convictions, including DUIs, assault charges, and fraud. As a result, he had his Order of Canada rescinded in 2009 and died from medical complications, speculated to be a seizure, but I couldn't find a certain answer, in 2022. So he is no longer on the rolls for the Order of Canada. So is he the youngest holder? No, but he was the youngest person to receive it. So this journalist, Radley, had spent a week with Fonio in 2005, and that was not long after the Greatest Canadian Contest, and, you know, this episode came out. He spent a week with him to write a thoughtful piece on Fonio and how he was beginning to turn his life around at that point. Radley wrote, rather honestly, quote, Fonio wasn't Fox. He was never as good looking or as smooth in front of a microphone, and his parents spoke with thick Hungarian accents that sounded gruff. If ever someone was going to play Camilla to Fox's Diana, this was the man.
Oh, wow. That's...
that's a brutal metaphor.
But it sounds like it's fitting.
It does sound fitting. When I read this, I thought, like, okay, did his parents speaking with thick Hungarian accents really play much into this? But as soon as you said at the beginning, oh, they really make a lot out of the home life and the all-Canadian, like, idyllic, you know, white picket fence upbringing, that did come to mind for me. And I thought it is interesting that this was also a dynamic. Like, Terry Fox's parents are part of the brand as well, right?
Yeah.
In the... I don't want to spoil it, but there's a later part of the Greatest Canadian series where they are introduced as part of his, like, his greater network of people. I think it was for the Vancouver Olympics. His mom was part of the torch relay as kind of a stand-in for him.
Yeah.
So, like, his parents are part of the brand. So what Fonio told Radley, like what the guy told the journalist, he said, quote, you can make a lot more money off a dead hero than a live one.
Yeah. And that's actually something I wrote in my notes, is that the donations went up when he died. They mention it in the pitch.
Right.
Is that the donations go up even more when he dies. And I'm like, well, that's...
It's the martyr thing, right?
Yeah. You know, it's what, you die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
And like, it's not to say that had Terry Fox lived, he would have become the villain because...
No.
Another person he's compared to is Rick Hansen. Have you heard of Rick Hansen?
No.
So Rick Hansen was also, he was in the top 100 somewhere for the greatest Canadian. My parents are the kind of people that are like, you know, they love the Terry Fox narrative. They had a big poster of Rick Hansen in the base, but they might still. Rick Hansen was paralyzed from the waist down, and he went like around the world, like not circumnavigating, but like thousands of kilometers in his wheelchair, including like along the Great Wall of China. Really cool thing. Mm-hmm. Rick Hansen is still alive. He did this in the 80s. He never became a pariah. He was also like he was a big part of the Vancouver Olympics, like opening ceremonies and torch relay, and like he did a big speech and stuff. He is still very much this sort of like inspirational icon guy, right? Mm-hmm. I do think it's worth considering what Radley wrote. So that first part was from 2005, right? Where he's saying like he's the Camilla to Fox's Diana.
Yeah.
2022, Fonio dies and Radley writes another piece. He says, quote, "At a time we're supposed to be more enlightened about addiction and possibly mental health problems, the near-complete purge of Fonio from the public narrative somehow seems unfair. Especially when you wonder if this would have happened to him had he not faced the pressures of fame and expectations he was obviously ill-equipped to handle. All in the pursuit of raising money for charity. We can't know, but it's a fair question to ask."
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's a fair question to ask, definitely.
You know, I will say this for the millionth time. I have no interest in trying to besmirch Terry Fox's character or what he actually did. Mm-hmm. For all we know, it is beyond his control that he was not able to complete his whole run.
Yeah.
But we talk about him running from St. John's to Thunder Bay for the incredible achievement as it is. Mm-hmm. This other guy who also did it on one leg, covered the width of the country, and it sounds like he got a lot of adulation at the time.
Yeah.
So this is a few years later, this is in the 80s. By the time I was growing up in the 90s, I never heard this guy's name. I had never, ever come across it. And there's other little wrinkles, like he went to the Canadian Cancer Society, I think. I meant to write a note of this, but it was Fonio went to someone before he started his run in the interest of support and was turned away. I had seen this framed, I think it might have been Radley's article, saying that people were image conscious about the branding. They were kind of worried about messing up the Terry Fox legacy. I believe it was a Canadian Cancer Society. I believe they did go on the record as saying like, oh no, like he did great things, like when they were interviewed about this.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the guy didn't get as much support out the gate because I think it is fair to at least suggest like, was this too messy for anyone to support him? And again, once he started doing it, he got more support. In the one article, it makes a point of saying, as soon as he passed the point where Terry Fox stopped, is when people really started to pay attention to him. That was when it was no longer messy. And it was like, now we can rally behind this guy. And then he got into his personal issues, which like he has to take responsibility to an extent for what he did. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it sounds like it's just very unfortunate.
Yeah.
But like the journalist said, he seemed very sincere.
Yeah. But I mean, having a leg amputated as a teenager is not going to be great for your long-term mental health, like no matter what else happens. Mm-hmm. One thing is that there, it does always seem to be more attention for the person that does something first. I was talking to the Failure to Launch guys about this, actually, when we were talking about moon conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. The Apollo 11 landing got so much attention. And then they did several more landings and it kind of, no one cared.
Yeah.
Like some of them weren't even televised and stuff like that. And then you get conspiracy theories years later going, well, how come they never did it again? And I'm like, well, they did. It's just that it was, people stopped caring. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I do think there's probably an element of that. It's just that he didn't do it first.
Yeah.
And then it makes sense that once he started to get further, people are like, oh, okay, this is new. Now this is new. But yeah, that also that Terry Fox basically died while doing it means that, to slightly coldly go back to our conversation about filler right at the beginning, there was only a short story to tell. Because, I mean, you could make a redeeming arc of it. You know, you said this guy was trying to get his life together in 2005. And, you know, you can tell a rise, fall, rise story there.
And someone did. They made a documentary about him in 2015, actually, I believe. So maybe we'll cover that later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of filler to pad out the story that was told. And I mean, look how much time we spent talking about the story that wasn't told. So
yeah,
there's a lot there as well. I think we covered it for today.
Mm-hmm.
Kirstie, how do you feel after discussing this straightforward, over the plate, unequivocal, unproblematic hero that everyone loves? How do you feel?
Well, I think we found some problems, not in the hero himself, but
yeah,
in the story that's being told.
Like Sukhyun Lee says in this thing, this is one of the notes that we didn't cover, but she said, oh yeah, the country was consumed by political squabbling. Like what, when is it not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I will say that in 2004, when The Greatest Canadian was made, I do think that we didn't have the same level of like very partisan polarization we have now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Tommy Douglas would win if it happened today. I think there would be way too much social media push to, you know, brand him as a dangerous commie.
Yeah.
You know, like Pierre Trudeau was third. None of these people, I think, would rank so high, these prime ministers and politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if there's anyone who's come up in the last 20 years that really unites people. I think Terry Fox would win. He's still very much in the public consciousness.
All right.
And like, for what it's worth, I don't even think it's a bad choice.
No.
I just think it is frustrating that we still love to tell these simple stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, isn't that a theme of your podcast? Hey, plug your podcast.
Yeah. So Our Stories and Ourselves, it's about all the ways our minds make stories and stories make us. Basically what we've been talking about for in the raw audio, 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the fact that we can build stories out of any bits of information. Sometimes that's good. It helps us remember things. Sometimes it's bad. We see two unrelated facts, connect them, and then make a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the way that these stories make us, how much of human action is driven by various stories that we tell ourselves on all podcast platforms.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a listener. I've listened to every episode. I really enjoy it. I'm interested to see where you go with it. So the links for that will also be in the description below. You will also find other links, like you can join our Discord for free and come chat with us about these episodes. You can come chat with Kirstie as well.
Yep.
Ask about her podcast. And you also see our Patreon down there. So speaking of places you can give your money, if you have enjoyed this and you want to hear more of this, there is no greater charity. I will tell you exactly what percentage of your Patreon dollar goes to me. It is 92% because Patreon takes an 8% cut. But all of that is directly into me being able to pay rent and eat because it is my only source of income. Do you think it's worth $5 a month, Kirstie?
I've been enjoying it so far. Yep.
Speaking as a patron,
speaking
yet
as
another
a patron,
person paying for the privilege of being on this podcast right now.
Yeah. Why am I doing that? Kidding.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But thank you. I appreciate it.
Don't sign up via Apple. Sign up via your browser.
Yes, thank you.
Otherwise, Apple takes a cut as well.
Yeah, because Apple will take 30% additional. So it's like, I don't know how to do math when it's 30 additional and 8 below. But yeah, an additional 30 cents on the dollar will be added directly to Apple. Does not go to me. Does not even go to Patreon. And certainly does not go to Kirstie, who is doing this for free. So check that out. If you have any money to give, all of it is appreciated. You will get access. You will get expanded access to the Discord. You will get access to all of our bonus content at the highest level. You can commission me to make some art. If you are already paying at the highest level, give me your prompts for that art because we...
You owe a lot of people.
People have been paying me to do it and not asking me to do it, and I feel guilty. So send in your prompts for the art.
And if you can't think of anything, post in the Discord and we'll generate some stuff together.
Yeah, I'll start giving out your prompts away to other people. That's what I'll do. Yeah, and we'll start getting some more stuff in there. And every single time I actually had pulled up the list of patrons going, oh, I should do the thank the patrons thing. And then once again, I forgot, but we did run long. So next episode, we will thank the new patrons.
Thank you, new patrons. You know who you are.
So we have to do the thing we do every episode, but it is brutally simple. We play 6 Degrees of Strombo. How do we connect all of this to our beloved friend, noted multimedia heartthrob George Strombolopoulos? Well, Sukhyun Lee, for one thing, is friends with him. I believe they're pictured on Instagram together. They were both Much Music VJs together. pretty straightforward. They are kind of just the same person. They are both, I think we could call them both multimedia heartthrobs. Strombo just got more exposure because of institutional sexism, probably. And Terry Fox himself, he got to meet so many people on his run. One of the people I believe is mentioned in the episode is hockey star Bobby Orr, who has been interviewed by Strombo. So bingo bango. One day this game might be hard, but it is not. Yeah, I've connected both of these people separately to him. So the episode is well covered. Yeah, I think when I was looking at his Instagram and he was just like, here's a picture with my good friend. We've been friends for 25 years. And I'm like, well, yeah, you work together. That makes sense. So.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of people I've worked with that I'm not friends with.
Working backward from that logic, it makes sense. We know how they met. So
yeah,
that's it. All we have left to do is, do you want to say the catchphrase and we'll be out of here?
Je m'en calisse.
Canuck is a Slur is an independent collaborative effort to present a critical, progressive perspective on Canadian history and culture. Drop them. To make consistent, high-quality content, we need your support. Let's tangle. Head on over to patreon.com/Canuck is a Slur to sign up. Beauty. If you're still on the fence, well, here's the sales pitch. Patrons at the good old Canadian boy level unlock expanded access to our Discord server, including sneak peeks at upcoming episodes. Let's go! Patrons at the good old Ontario boy level will also get into our archive of bonus content, which includes an extra episode every month. Patrons at the good old Kingston boy level get to commission a free piece of bad art every month as well, in addition to further special Discord privileges.
Oh, how she loves the Stanley Cup. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go. Listen to what I say. Play that game the Canadian way. Hockey man is what I am. Let's go.
We'd love for you to come and follow us on our various socials, which you can find linked in the episode description. You can also see any further links for our guests and co-hosts there as well. The creators of this work would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples across the continent that had their homes stolen, land broken up by arbitrary borders, cultures suppressed, languages banned, children kidnapped, and who were subjected to many other forms of colonial violence. We also acknowledge the many treaties broken and still unceded territories across Turtle Island. Thanks for listening, eat the rich, and happy trails to you.
Hooray for editing, right?
Yep.
I'm going to be interested to see what you do with this.
I'm going to try to get it down to 90 minutes. I'll probably cut some tangents. But also this stuff all cuts very easily.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.